Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today, we return to the archives and continue reading from the October 2016 issue of Guideposts with articles like Released. Released, the power of forgiveness. Imagine spending 4 years of your life in prison for something you didn't do. Now imagine trying to forgive the man who sent you there. By Jameel McGee, Benton Harbor, Michigan. The Job for Life program looked like a good fit for an ex-con like me. 8 weeks of classes for people who had done prison time and needed help reintegrating into the workforce. We were learning stuff like interview techniques, how to write a resume, how to deal with stress at work. There was a position waiting for me when I graduated, a good job at a cafe run by a nonprofit. For the first time since my release, 5 years before, something was going right for me. Initially, I didn't want to sign up. I told the caseworker, Mrs. Deb, that sitting in a classroom wasn't my thing. I liked working with my hands, but the last job I'd had was at a metal finishing plant, and while there, I injured myself. I couldn't afford the surgery the doctor said I needed and was soon out of work. For a while now, I'd been sleeping in my brother's car, homeless and hopeless. But Mrs. Deb wouldn't give up on me. She tracked me down, gave me a bicycle, and 5 changes of clothes. I was blown away. Couldn't remember when anyone had done anything that nice. "Okay," I said, feeling obligated. "I'll give it a shot." 3 weeks in, I hadn't missed a class. Always sat in the third row, soaking everything up. I loved the way the teacher, Miss P, got everybody talking. I began to open up myself, began to see that I wasn't the only one who suffered and had been mistreated. One day, Miss P announced we were going to meet our mentors. "Your mentor," she explained, "will be the person who can guide you through the next steps. They can help you move forward." She said that God had placed on her heart that a certain person should be my mentor. "Who is it?" I asked. She told me. I stared at her in disbelief. It was a name I'd hope I'd never have to hear again. Anger made my hand shake. What kind of sick joke was this? "Is there a problem?" Miss P asked. "Is there a problem?" I spat the words out. I hardly knew where to begin. February 8, 2005, my girlfriend had just given birth to a beautiful baby boy, and I was going over to her place to see him. Everything was going great for me. I worked at a car wash, had recently been promoted to manager, I had a good relationship with my girlfriend, and I was so proud to have a son. I wanted to pick up some groceries, and I got a ride with my cousin and his friend. I knew they were into drugs, but I was clean. I just needed to do this one errand. I was heading into the store. "Let me use your phone," the friend said. I tossed it to him and went inside. Next thing I know, I'm coming out of the store and a police officer is running toward me. "Where's the dope?" he shouted. "I don't do drugs," I said as respectfully as I could. He patted me down and ordered me not to move. He went back to the truck. I told myself this would all be cleared up in a few minutes. Instead, I was put under arrest, charged with possessing crack cocaine. I figured everything would get straightened out at the police station. I was innocent. Didn't have any crack on me. I'd been in trouble before as a juvenile, but I'd gotten my life together. I'd turned myself around. If I told my story, I was sure I could set everyone straight. But no one would listen. Even my lawyer, a public defender, didn't seem to believe me. He hardly put up a defense at the trial. Everybody brought what the officer, Andrew Collins, testified under oath to, that I had made a call to a known drug dealer. "That was a call another guy made on my phone when I was in the store," I tried to explain. Collins insisted that he had found an ounce of cocaine in the cup holder of a truck I'd been driving. "That wasn't mine," I insisted truthfully. Collins testified smoothly. He had his story down all right, except it was a lie, and he knew it. Still, the judge pounded his gavel and sentenced me to 10 years in prison. I vowed that day that if I got out, I would hunt Andrew Collins down and make him pay. The other inmates quickly learned to stay away from me. I was burning up with rage. Just a nod in my direction and I'd fly off the handle. This was justice. It was a sham. If I couldn't get to Officer Collins, I'd go after someone else. One day I looked down in my cell and I noticed a Bible another inmate had left behind. I hadn't paid it any attention before, but now it seemed to be speaking to me. I didn't open it up, didn't read a word, but I could hear its warning. "Watch out. Look at what your anger will do. It'll destroy you." I had a job working in the prison yard, pulling weeds, spreading mulch. I pounded the ground with my shovel, imagining I was pummeling Officer Collins, burying him. But then I'd come to my cell and see that Bible. My mom had read the Bible to me when I was little. It had never made much sense to me, but here in prison, I finally opened it up and began reading. Maybe because I was in so much pain, the story spoke to me. I could identify with the apostles Peter and Paul. They had been wrongly accused and beaten. They had done hard time. I read about Jesus and his mockery of a trial, the torture he endured. "Let it go," I heard a voice bigger than my rage say. "This is my battle. Vengeance is mine." Don't ask me how, but I agreed to let it go. If the big guy wanted to fight for me, I wasn't going to stop him. I wasn't doing a very good job of it myself. And I was so tired of this sick, angry feeling eating away at me. A week later, February 4th, 2009, my name kept being called on the loudspeaker. "Report to the counselor's office." I paid no attention. I figured the counselor was still trying to get me to join a drug rehab program because it would look good for the parole board. I turned him down once and would turn him down again. Just because a cop had lied was no reason for me to lie. The counselor finally tracked me down. He handed me a fax from the governor's office. I thought it was a joke. I was being released? Come on, man, who are you kidding? The counselor set me straight. My conviction had been overturned. I went straight to the ward, then took a taxi to the bus station and headed home before they could change their minds. I felt like God really had my back. On the outside, I learned why. Officer Collins had been convicted of planting evidence and setting up innocent people in more than 50 different cases. In return for testifying against other corrupt cops, he'd been sentenced to 18 months in prison. 18 months, when I had been given 10 years. All the rage came back like a smoldering fire that had blazed up again. I struggled to get my life together, but the anger consumed me. I bounced from job to job, but at least I managed to see my son. One day when he was six, I took him to the park and we ran into, you guessed it, Andrew Collins. Out of prison now, his brief time served, I raced up to him. "Hey, you remember me?" I said and stuck out my hand. "Yeah," he said. He shook my hand and started apologizing. I'm thinking, hit him, make him pay. But God was saying so clearly in my head, let it go. I dropped his hand and asked him to explain to my son why I missed out on 4 years of his life. Then I walked off, feeling relieved that it was over. I would never have to see him again. Now here I was in a classroom for a jobs program that I thought would be my salvation, and Miss P was giving me his name. This guy was going to be my mentor? Miss P had no idea we had a history. She told me she could find another mentor for me if I wanted. I felt more confused than angry. Can I have a minute to pray about this? Take all the time you need. I bowed my head right there at my desk. God, tell me which way to go, I prayed. I don't want to be angry anymore. This anger is holding me back. I opened my eyes and saw a picture in our class workbook. Two figures, one pulling the other up. That's how it worked in this program. That's how it worked in life. I'll meet with Andrew, I told Miss P. He's ready for you, she said. Soon I was sitting across from the man I'd hated more than anyone else on earth, the man I had wanted to make pay for his sins, the man I blamed all my pain on, the man who had imprisoned me, not just behind bars, but in the shackles of my own rage. I'd walked out of the prison a free man legally. Spiritually, I was still in a cell. Yet I had found God who could take that all away if I could only take the first step. "Hey, I used to be a city police officer," Andrew started by saying. "If I harmed you or your family, I'm sorry." I cut him off. "You don't remember me, do you?" He didn't recognize me because I had a shaved head now. When he realized who he was, he said, "I'm so sorry." "Stop," I said. "It's over. It's done." The words spoken as truthfully as anything I'd ever said lifted a weight off me, a burden I'd dragged around like a ball and chain. If God could forgive Andrew, surely I could. Surely I must. It's been more than a year now since I was paired with my mentor. I feel as if it was a reprieve. I have a full-time job at the cafe. I work side by side with my friend, Andrew Collins. Animals and Healing, Heart of a Champion. A Young Woman Who Had Lost All Hope and a Horse Who Had Lost His Sight by Morgan Wagner, Eugene, Oregon. Just breathe, I told myself. Any tension in my body would be mirrored in my horse, Endo, and he needed to be relaxed. In a minute, we would enter the show ring at the Oregon Horse Center to compete in the second phase of a discipline known as working equitation. The sport focuses on the partnership between the horse and the rider, particularly the equestrian skills used in working cattle. It uses various tests, dressage, ease of handling, speed, to showcase a horse's athletic ability and willingness. The second phase, ease of handling, is an obstacle course that reflects challenges the horse and rider are likely to encounter in the field. Endo and I were competing at the intermediate level, and there were 11 obstacles on our course today. For the last, we'd have to jump from a canter without stopping and clear an elevated rail, something we had yet to do in competition. Horses warmed up behind us, their hooves thudding on the sand. Endo chomped his bit and swiveled his ears whenever one passed. He couldn't see any of them. 3 years ago, he'd lost his eyes. Since then, he adapted to a world of total darkness by developing an extraordinary sense of smell and hearing, not to mention trust in me. Today, I would be testing that trust. Why in the world would someone ride, much less jump, a blind horse? That's a question I get a lot. Maybe it goes back to the connection I felt with Endo from the beginning. I met him 15 years before when I was 13. I just moved with my mother and sister from California to my grandmother's small horse farm in Oregon. Grandma raised Appaloosas. One day she introduced me to three foals playing in the paddock. Two came over and nosed us for treats. "I know it was hard leaving your friends," Grandma said. "Why don't you pick out a new friend? You can have any foal you want." I smiled at the two whose whiskery noses nuzzled my arms, but my gaze was drawn to the shy foal across the paddock. He had a red coat with white spots, large, intelligent eyes, and a different presence from the other foals. "I want that one," I told my grandmother. I knew absolutely nothing about raising and training horses back then, so Endo and I learned and grew up together. I couldn't afford formal lessons, but that didn't stop us from trying everything we could at home, from trail riding to Western games. We became best friends. Sometimes it felt like Endo was the only friend I had, the only one who understood. Outside the show ring, I exhaled deeply as my inflamed lungs would allow. I felt Endo relax under me. We used to love to jump together for fun, sailing over obstacles I set up in my grandmother's field. That was before a chronic, painful autoimmune disease called uveitis stole Endo's sight. And another chronic, painful autoimmune disease, lupus, stole my future. The ring steward motioned us in. I saluted the judge. Endo quivered with excitement that barely contained energy he always has before working obstacles. I cued him and we began the course. The first obstacle, smoothly cantering a figure eight around some barrels. This does not appear difficult to spectators, particularly those who aren't familiar with the equestrian sports. It's kind of like my lupus. Because I look fine on the outside, people don't understand what's happening on the inside. My immune system attacks my own body, my joints, lungs, kidneys, and other organs. We rounded several cones and slalomed through a line of poles. Since my health collapsed, my life had seemed like a series of obstacles. It started in my mid-teens with vague symptoms. Exhaustion, red marks on my face, random fevers. My health took a dramatic downturn shortly after I moved out on my own at 19. My joints were achy and swollen. Sometimes I grabbed Endo's reins in my fist, unable to even unclench my hand. I had trouble breathing when I lay down at night. I went to the ER. Doctors were puzzled. Was it some sort of infection? Antibiotics didn't help. I had to sleep upright on my couch so I could breathe. Getting in my car to go to my job was an ordeal, requiring both hands to brace myself against the doorframe. I was working as a certified nursing assistant to save money to go to college and become a police officer. After work, I would lie on the cool linoleum floor of my kitchen, too exhausted to stand. I wondered if I was going crazy. Finally, I got a diagnosis, lupus. Blood work confirmed systemic inflammation wreaking havoc on my heart, lungs, kidneys, pancreas, and gallbladder. I was put on heavy-duty immunosuppressants. I was so sick I could barely function. I had to leave my job and apply for disability. Doctors said I'd be on dialysis before the age of 30 if things didn't improve. To me, it felt like the beginning of the end. My dream of becoming a police officer was dead. There was nothing to live for, nothing except endo. We rounded two potted trees. I whispered encouragement as we approached the gate. I had to open it, go through, then close it without letting go or dismounting. The ring was quiet. All I heard was my own labored breathing, the soft thud of Endo's hooves, then the creak of the hinges as I closed the gate. I'd come up against many closed doors in my 28 years. 3 years ago, there seemed to be no way forward. Endo had suffered from uveitis for a long time, and he was losing his battle, also known as moon blindness. The disease is common in Appaloosas. The immune system attacks eye tissue, and there are flare-ups, as with lupus. In severe cases, the damage to the eye leads to blindness. Not only was Endo's sight going, his eyes were hemorrhaging, and he was in terrible pain. The only option left was surgery to remove his eyes. He needed to be happy, even if he might not be rideable anymore. Me? I'd fallen into a black hole of depression. My friends had moved on to college, marriage, careers. I had no goals, no purpose, no hope. I started washing down my medication with alcohol. Not a good way to treat my fragile body, but I didn't care. If I were an animal, I would have been put down. I thought about ending my suffering with an overdose. What stopped me was Endo. Who would take care of him after he lost his eyes? Veterinarians don't have a lot of experience with horses that have no eye function at all, so they weren't able to tell me what Endo's life would be like after his world went completely dark. The day after his surgery, I made my way to the barn. What if he was thrashing about in his stall in terror, bumping into walls? What if he couldn't cope without being able to see shapes and light and darkness to orient himself? There was a cheerful whinny. "Hello, Endo," I said. I sat on a hay bale and watched him turn around in his stall. He didn't hit the walls or his feeder. Already he seemed to sense the boundaries of his enclosure and moved like a sighted horse. I changed his bandages and gave him some antibiotics. Then I lay in the corner of the stall to rest. He came closer and plucked mouthfuls of hay from the pile at my feet. Even without eyes, he knew where I was. He was okay trusting in dark. Maybe I could learn to do that too. After Endo surgery, I rededicated myself to riding. We worked together until he regained his sense of balance. Out in his pasture, he learned to smell, feel, and hear his way around trees and fencing. Sometimes he grew so bold I'd have to rein him in. For 2 years, I worked with him on jumping. We'd ride up to an elevated rail and stop so Endo could touch and smell it. Then I cued him verbally. Ready? 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 Jump! Jump! It was literally a leap of faith on his part and mine. In working equitation, a jump is mandatory, and for us to be competitive, we would have to jump without stopping. Even though Endo was willing to try anything I asked, I wasn't sure we could do it. My hands were aching now from holding the reins, but I took the long way around the ring to the final obstacle, the jump. Endo's ears pricked up in anticipation. This was the moment to stop if I changed my mind. Did I have the faith to attempt this jump? Just trust him. That's what my riding instructor had been telling me lately. When you get nervous, relax your grip on the reins and trust your horse more. We rode toward the jump. Endo was so willing, eager even, to move beyond his disability and live. Time for me to do the same. I cued the countdown. Ready? 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 Jump! Jump! In his excitement, Endo took a premature hop. Then he leaped. I held his neck for stability. For a second, we were flying. Then we landed and cantered between the two American flags, marking the end of the course. I saluted the judge and patted Endo's neck as he pranced out of the ring. We did it, I said. Good boy. We took first place for that show. I hung the blue ribbon from the rearview mirror in my car. A reminder to move forward in faith when the world seems dark. I don't know the obstacles that lie ahead of me. That's the reality of living with lupus. But from Endo, I'm learning to trust that something or someone will be there to guide me through. I'm listening. Ready, ready, ready. Jump, jump. For more on this story, see Family Room. I'm Sandy Summers, and you are listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you may access it anytime on demand at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guidepost magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guidepost's other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts Online. And now from Guideposts Online. Guideposts, your weekly inspiration, a summer of spiritual simplicity, June 16th, 2025. A summer of spiritual simplicity, 10 everyday practices to help you live with greater intention, by Guidepost Editors. Looking to align your life with what truly matters, these 10 simple practices create space for peace, presence, and the steady whisper of God's love. Number 1, start with stillness. Begin each morning with 5 quiet minutes. No phone, no agenda, just you and God. Number 2, build breathing room into your day. Leave space between appointments or tasks. Use that time to stretch, pray, or breathe. Number 3, celebrate one small thing a day. Instead of rushing past the ordinary, savor it. A warm cup of coffee, a shared smile, bird song at dusk. Acknowledge it as a gift from God. Number 4, listen to soulful sounds. Create a playlist of music that calms and lifts your spirit. Instrumental hymns, nature sounds, or worship songs. Let it become a peaceful soundtrack to your day. Number 5, curate a spirit-filling playlist or podcast queue. Choose a few uplifting podcasts or devotionals to listen to during commutes or chores. Let truth and encouragement replace noise and stress. Need a place to start? Try calming meditations and sleep stories from Abide. Number 6, keep a gratitude in the moment journal. Instead of a long list at the end of the day, jot quick notes in real time. A breeze, a good conversation, a moment of peace. Number 7, let one thing go each day. Say no to something small, a task, a habit, a worry, to say yes to more peace. Ask, will this matter in eternity? Number 8, take a break, unplug from screens for 1 hour a day or 1 day a week. Rest is not a reward, it's a command and a blessing. Number 9, move prayerfully. Take a short walk and use the time to pray for loved ones, reflect, or simply listen for God's voice in the rhythm of your steps. Number 10, create a sacred end-of-day ritual. Wind down with a candle, a short scripture, or a few lines of reflection. Let the day close in peace, not pressure. Bonus, try an evening meditation from Abide to help you settle your spirit before sleep. Now we'll return to Guideposts, October 2016, with Joy at Work, the almost perfect business plan. More than half of new restaurants fail in the first year. Why did I think we would beat those odds? By Anthony Gentilsek, Haddon Township, New Jersey. Here you go, said our delivery guy, handing me the invoice, $589.37. More than we made in a typical day. I took a deep breath, trying not to freak out. Just 5 months before, my brother Joe, my sister Maria, and I opened Animo, a juice and burrito bar in Haddonville, the suburb of Philadelphia where we grew up. I had left a good job as the director of sales for a golf course, put a lien on our house, and taken out a small business loan for $120,000 to get us started. Now, the way things were going, we would barely make it another week. I unpacked the boxes of organic kale, rainbow Swiss chard, juicing carrots, wheatgrass, beets, oranges, and fair trade bananas. In my head, I frantically ran the numbers, as if it might somehow add up to a different result. My siblings and I had been passionate about good food ever since we were kids, watching our mom make dinner from scratch every night. Whether it was rolling meatballs by hand or grating potatoes for kugelis, a specialty from Lithuania, her homeland. Mom loved being a full-time mother, raising the seven of us. Once I, the youngest, was in third grade, she pursued a second career and went to law school. She also ran marathons and hosted her own radio show. She taught us about the Hill of Crosses in Lithuania, a symbol of perseverance under Soviet oppression. They bulldozed the hill three times, but pilgrims just put up more crosses, and told us that with faith, nothing was impossible. Everything she'd accomplished was proof. When Mom died of cancer in 2003, I wanted to do something in her honor. Jo Maria and I always talked about opening a restaurant serving healthy, all-natural food. We decided it was time. More than a half of new restaurants fail in the first year, people warned us. Now I knew why. Jo and I were putting in more than 70 hours a week. Maria, who juggled her five children and working at Animo, was exhausted too. And there was Will Delise, our one employee. She had two young girls who often came to visit the store. She depended on the job to support them. What was she going to do if we closed? I hadn't dared to voice my worries, not even to my wife, Jen. We'd been married for 3 years and went back as a couple more than 10 years to when we were high school sweethearts living across the street from each other. Grace, our 1.5-year-old, kept Jen busy. She was pregnant with our second child due in 3 months. What would she say when she heard that we would lose everything? An hour till opening, Joe said. He helped me load the rest of the produce into the walk-in. Our handful of morning regulars would arrive soon. I felt great ever since I'd been coming here, one woman told us 2 days earlier, ordering her favorite wheatgrass juice. Thank you for what you guys do, said another. I love starting my day with a healthy breakfast. Compliments like that confirmed that what we served were really high quality, and that the fact that people who tried our food and drinks kept coming back. The problem was, there weren't enough of them. At lunchtime, Jen came in carrying Grace. Dada, our daughter exclaimed, reaching for me. That's all the time we have today for Guidepost. We'll finish reading The Almost Perfect Business Plan next time. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.